Hello, everyone. This is Mireille Génaud, and you're listening to the New Books in African American Studies podcast. Joining me today is Professor Edley Wong, currently Associate Professor in the English Department at the University of Maryland. Professor Wong is the co-editor of George Lippert's The Killers and the author of Neither Fugitive Nor Free, Atlantic Slavery, Freedom Suits, and the Legal Culture of Travel. She's also the author of Racial Construction, Black Inclusion, Chinese Exclusion, and the Fictions of Citizenship, published by New York University Press, which is the book we'll be discussing today. Professor Wong, welcome to the podcast.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Not at all. I wonder if you'd begin by telling us a bit about yourself.
Well, you've covered a lot of the basics. I'm an associate professor of English at the University of Maryland. Previous to coming to Maryland, I was an associate professor at Rutgers, and much of my work is really invested in exploring the kind of expansive impact of Atlantic slavery and slave trade on American life, social relations, and culture. And I have to really chart my inspiration to my dissertation advisor and mentor, Saidiya Hartman, whose brilliance and just political passion really shaped, I think, a generation of graduate students coming through the halls of Berkeley English.
Great. Great. Can you say more about how Dr. Hartman's work and mentorship influenced your work?
Certainly. So, as a young undergraduate, I was an undergraduate student at UC Berkeley, and at the time in which I entered my undergraduate years, it was the summer of the 1992 LA riots. And in terms of my intellectual development, it was really a flashpoint where there was really a call to develop or think about new racial paradigms for understanding kind of antagonisms and alliance, differentiation within kind of racial groups, really an effort to kind of create new paradigms for understanding race in America, especially given the kind of mass media coverage, which really placed Afro-Asian tension and conflict at the forefront of U.S. public consciousness, and the subsequent efforts by politicians and other kind of political commentators to really reframe that particular episode as a kind of black-white kind of binary, a black-white cultural kind of moment in U.S. history. So that really kind of catalyzed my interest in studying racial formations, understanding the nature of race in American social life. And I brought that kind of interest to my graduate studies, which was also at UC Berkeley. And the person who really kind of catalyzed my interest in exploring in greater depth early African American cultural politics and cultural productions was Professor Saidiya Hartman, who had just published her book, Scenes of Subjection, and is currently working on her second monograph, Lose Your Mother. So it all really kind of came to a head under her mentorship. And the product of that is my first book, which you mentioned, Neither Fugitive Nor Free. And it really continues on in a more kind of comparative and expansive framework in my second book, Racial Reconstruction.
Great. Well, that's the book that we're really kind of focusing on today, the first chapter of which is Cosa de Cuba, which subtitled American Literary Travels, Empire, and the Contract Coolie. And I wonder if you'd tell us a bit about how that chapter unfolds. I found it a really fascinating chapter, in no small part because you really look closely at this what you characterize as an under-examined archive of Anglo-American Cuba travelogues.
Certainly. The book really begins with this first chapter that you mentioned, and my effort in this chapter was to recover this lesser-known episode in the archives of New World slavery. And in that sense, the abolition of the slave trade and emancipation really triggered massive labor shortages throughout the British and Spanish Caribbean and later in the U.S. South. And planters and agriculturalists began turning to Asia, specifically China and India, and began experimenting really with indentured or bonded laborers from these locations. Many of these laborers worked under contracts of 7 to 8 years. And the very idea of contract gave this labor force a semblance of free or voluntary labor. But the workers were subject to the coercions and exploitations common under the conditions of slavery. And specifically in this chapter, I focus on Cuba, where slavery remained legal until 1886. So the importation of Chinese contract laborers, who were often referred to as coolies or coolie slaves, they worked and labored alongside Black Creole slaves and underwent similar kinds of treatment in terms of their lack of legal recourse and rights as laborers in Cuba from this period of roughly about 1847 to 74, where Cuba was very active in the kind of experimentation with this quasi-free labor force. And the important thing to note was that the U.S. was hugely involved in this quote-unquote coolie trade. U.S. ships dominated the transport of Chinese laborers to Cuba. And in fact, this facilitated kind of a crisis within the U.S. Reformers were really active in petitioning state and federal governments to ban the U.S. participation in the coolie trade. Many saw it as another form of a slave trade that was banned in 1808, and saw it as a kind of interdiction of the U.S., you know, Anti-Foreign Slave Trade Act. All of this came to a head finally in 1862 when President Lincoln finally passed the Coolie Trade Prohibition Act. And this was just months before the Emancipation Proclamation Act. And it banned the U.S. participation in the transport of Chinese coolies to the Caribbean. And this chapter really kind of sets the stage for later chapters that really explore the kind of braided histories of African-American and Asian-American, specifically Chinese-American, struggles over the question of citizenship, immigration, and rights in the U.S. context. And this chapter really emphasizes how the specter of what became known as the coolie slave trade influenced sectional debates over U.S. slavery, and later on, in the aftermath of slavery, Black citizenship struggles in rather understudied and perhaps lesser known ways. And ultimately, the chapter really begs the question of how we've come to understand the era of slavery and the histories that come from this period. It's really kind of pushing us to think more expansively about what emancipation entailed in the New World and in the West at large.
Right, because you one of the bigger themes in this chapter is this idea of the U.S. defining post-emancipation freedoms a lot of the time in relation to what's going on in colonial Cuba and this emergent idea of the coolie slave, which I would love it if you would kind of distinguish this notion of the contract coolie versus the coolie slave and these sort of competing constructions that fall in my reading, which may not be correct, along sort of these abolitionist versus pro-slavery lines.
That's a really good question. So the very idea of the coolie itself is deeply problematic. The term itself, coolie, has many different points of origination, Tamil, Chinese, Gujarati languages. In one context, it's still seen as a rather derogatory term in our contemporary context, the term coolie. And in my book, I'm really using the term as a provocation to think about these ways in which forms of quasi-free or free labor really become a guise or a way of, let's say, covering under the legal apparatus of contract. You sign a contract voluntarily to labor as a way in which forms of kind of unfree labor continued under the guise of free contract labor. And so the work that I'm trying to do in this chapter and throughout the book is to really tease out what historian Moon Ho Jung has talked about as the coolie as a kind of conglomeration of racial imaginings. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of fantasy that was produced in a lot of the discourse in the late 19th century to really understand or come to terms with this racialized labor force that seemed at times to be a kind of harbinger of free labor, and for others seemed a kind of recapitulation of Black enslaved labor, but in another form, in Chinese coolie or South Asian coolie laborers. So in my book, I try to parse the difference between the figure of the contract coolie and the way in which it became reimagined in the U.S. context as the coolie slave, mm-hmm. as an argument against Chinese immigration to the U.S. It often referred back to the past of abolitionist struggles to recast Chinese immigration, which was voluntary and free to the U.S., as a new form of slavery, the kind of slavery of cheap laborers who would basically cause the ruination of America in the post-emancipation present, that it was a kind of throwback to a earlier and feudal mode of labor. So a lot of the work is trying to parse the difference between how contract became a way for a new form of unfree labor to reemerge within the context of the West at large, the U.S. as well as the Caribbean.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting, because again, early in the book, you sort of pose the rhetorical question of whether the coolie is a throwback to slavery's past or a harbinger of freedom's future. And this sort of pivot point you also alluded to when you're talking about the reformers who initially welcomed indentured Chinese as this transitional labor force, but then later sort of took a different turn and were forcefully sort of against Chinese labor. So I wonder to touch on something that you just mentioned, which is the Coolie Trade Prohibition Act of 1862. I thought it very interesting that you cast it as arguably the last slave trade regulation and the first federal immigration restriction. And I wonder if you could sort of talk about that particular sort of pivot point.
Well, in terms of the U.S. context in which I discuss in the book, it really serves as this kind of pivot point, because it really kind of coalesces or kind of offers a kind of flashpoint for the kind of braided histories that I'm trying to explore in this book. So 1862, just months before the Emancipation Proclamation, which would really reshape the nature of the Civil War, really explicitly articulate it with not just the sectional crisis over states' rights, but specifically about an issue related to slavery in America. So just about roughly 3 months before that, the Coolie Prohibition Act is signed into being by Lincoln. And it really kind of serves as a kind of anticipatory moment in which you have the kind of linking of something like the past history of slave codes and slave laws in the U.S. with its articulation with a kind of emergent body of law that we might call U.S. immigration law. Mm-hmm. And for me, it really serves as a way to think through these histories of Atlantic slavery, slave trade, abolition, and emancipation in ways that haven't really been thought through in relationship to the subsequent history of U.S. immigration law and the first kind of great wave of Asian immigrants to the U.S., Chinese American immigrants to the U.S. in roughly the 70s and 80s, leading to the first racially based Immigration Restriction Act, which is the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act. So for my book, that moment, the 1862 moment, really serves as you said, a really profound pivot point to look at how these kinds of histories that aren't often seen in relationship to each other really come together in this moment as the U.S. was really in the midst of a war to redefine itself as a free nation. And the outcomes, as we know, at that time were not so secure. So it's a really kind of pivotal moment, as you say in the book. And even in my estimation for the question of race and immigration in the subsequent decades after Reconstruction. Mm-hmm.
And that sort of brings us, I think, really nicely to your second chapter, which is titled From Emancipation to Exclusion, Racial Analogy in Afro-Asian Periodical Print Culture. And there you're using, sort of close readings of periodical print output to discuss, I think, in a different way, maybe what you just alluded to, right? These histories that we're not used to sort of examining together. And I wonder if you would sort of talk about this and talk about how these sort of popular discourses sort of juxtapose these racialized groups.
Certainly. So the second chapter pulls away from perhaps the broader material histories of Chinese immigration to the West under the guise of coolieism to really focus specifically on a few underexamined writers, both African-American and Asian-American, to look at how these writers were, in a way, trying to theorize something like an understanding of racial difference or particularity in relationship to a kind of emergent understanding of American nationality. So I look to figures who have gone, more or less understudied, figures like James Williams, who produced a postbellum slave narrative. He was a former slave in Maryland, escaped, had a really interesting and colorful life in Philadelphia, worked for the Underground Railroad, and later in life found himself in California, in the West, as a gold miner. And his really kind of hybrid postbellum slave narrative has these really interesting passages, observations on the Chinese in California. And they really start to think about kind of Black identity formation in the era of emancipation in relationship to other minoritarian kind of groups, specifically Asian Americans in the West. Another figure that I look at is Frederick Douglass, who is very familiar and well-known, but I focus specifically on speech of his entitled Composite Nation. It also goes under another title, Composite Nationality, in which he really offers perhaps one of the most profoundly emphatic endorsements of Chinese immigration, naturalization, and citizenship rights from the period. The speech itself dates from, I believe, 1869, and it is far more emphatic than many of his, compatriots in the Republican Party. For example, Wendell Phillips was far more ambivalent about Chinese immigration to the U.S. And in the speech, again, like with James Williams' postbellum slave narrative, Douglas is really trying to theorize a really kind of complex and textured understanding of racial particularity and American nationality, one that is inclusive as opposed to exclusive in nature. And in many ways, I see these writers as trying to think through something that I had been struggling with, you know, in 1992 and onwards, trying to come to an understanding of race in America that really attended to questions of antagonism, alliance, difference, as well as similarity. And this is, of course, 200 years before my, you know, attempts to understand this body of thought and racial thinking. Another figure that I look at is part of the larger recovery work that I do in the book, which is the work of Wong Chin-Fu. He is perhaps one of the earliest writers of Asian American descent, specifically Chinese American, a really prolific newspaperman with hundreds of articles in newspapers and journals and literary magazines of the day. And it's only been very recently that people started looking at his work and rereading and revisiting his writings. His earliest writing dates from 1874, and it's a interesting translation, and translations in quotations, since he really served as the kind of amanuensis with editorial kind of power to interpret and change the text as he saw fit. But he produced what might be the first work of Asian American literature in English. And it is a fugitive coolie narrative, the story of a Chinese coolie in Cuba by the name of Chun Yang Hing. And what's really interesting, and what I kind of focus on in the book, is how this earliest production of Asian American literature adapts and retailers a genre, the slave narrative, that's so quintessentially African American, and also, you know, been theorized and discussed as a kind of formative genre to African American identity formation and self-expression, into an expression of Chinese American or Asian American life in the U.S. So that second chapter really starts focusing and pinpointing different figures, both African American and Asian American, who are offering maybe kind of a different way of understanding these vast kind of material changes that really came in the wake of emancipation and uneven emancipation throughout the New World, as a kind of consequence of the long and complex legacies of slavery and the slave trade in the U.S. and Caribbean.
And in sort of making that that move from the sort of legacy of the slave trade and the uneven emancipation that follows, this notion of Americanization, that seemed like the key point in common between Wong and Douglas, right? This understanding of Americanization as an inclusionary process. It seemed that they both sort of had shared that perspective. And I thought one of the really interesting points that you make in that chapter is in Douglas's speech, the composite nation lecture, talk about how he doesn't sort of merely dismiss this, you know, these yellow peril fears, but he actually inverts the dynamic of the invasion trope. And I wonder if you could sort of talk about that, that sort of move, that really interesting kind of deft move, which he was able to make.
Oh, certainly. So for the benefit of your auditors who may not know the term yellow peril, I'll just explain a little bit, and then I'll discuss how Douglas so deftly kind of retailers that figure in his speech. So for those of you less familiar with the term, yellow peril is kind of a catch-all phrase to describe just the complex, vast body, visual, textual documents that gave expression to the fears of Asian immigration, specifically Chinese immigration, to the U.S. at this time. Often it focused on the dangers, moral, social, economic, political, that these foreign immigrants might pose. Oftentimes it played on a language of public safety against a kind of contagion that was specifically racialized as Chinese and or Asian or Asiatic. In my later chapter, which I'm sure we'll talk about in just a bit, I focus specifically on one particular iteration of the yellow peril trope, which was in the figure of the Chinese invader, the idea of the Chinese or Asiatic invasion of the U.S. or the West at large. So in the Douglas speech, Composite Nation, what I found fascinating was that Douglas was very aware of this growing kind of discourse of yellow peril, the threat of Asiatic invasion and the taking over and destruction of American, quote unquote, American national values. And rather than dismissing it outright, what he does in the speech is to actually play out the idea of the potential kind of invasion or overtake of America by the kind of Asiatic hordes or Chinese hordes. And his argument is that if America is truly the nation that it proposes to be, that it shouldn't be threatened by the potential of this foreign difference invading its shores. That in fact, the kind of ideal of America is that it's a nation of religious freedom, that it's a nation of heterogeneity, so that it can take in difference without losing a sense of what and who it should be. So it's a kind of interesting take because in many ways he anticipates the kind of narratives of invasion that you'll see later on in the late 19th and early 20th century, where there is this kind of playing out of the potential of Asiatic difference or hordes overtaking the American nation, but rather than a dystopian understanding of what this difference will lead to, i.e. the destruction of America, Douglas sees it as invigorating,
right,
transforming, expanding the very basic tenets of what he imagines the ideal America to be. So that's fundamentally heterogeneity and difference as a kind of groundwork for how we might understand America at the very moment. I mean, these are the early years after the Civil War, just as America was trying to figure out its national destiny, what it would look like, what it would become as a free nation after hundreds of years of enslavement, a free America. And in Douglass's mind, it's an incredibly, perhaps some might call it even utopian vision, mm-hmm, that the fundamental kind of building blocks of America would be heterogeneity and difference as opposed to homogeneity and sameness.
Yeah, and we'll see. Douglas's sort of use of the counterfactual is interesting, and we'll see more of that later in the book. But I wonder if you would also talk a little bit about the sort of relating to what you just said about Douglas, right? This idea, the embrace of heterogeneity in the future of the nation, the sort of distinction between Wang Chun-Fu and Yan Fu Li, who both you know, newspaper, periodical, you know, had impressive freelance careers, but had sort of a slightly different or maybe slightly might be to understate it, but very different sort of understandings of how difference would be, could be absorbed into the emergent nation.
Okay. So, wanting to pronounce in here the two Asian American writers that I physically recover and study in this chapter alongside Douglas and James Williams. And the primary difference between Yan Fun Lee and Wang Chun-Fu is their use of a discourse of Christianity. And this is one of the other arguments that I make in the book, is that Christian discourse, specifically as it othered Chinese as heathens, became a primary way in which anti-Chinese immigrant forces attempted to really push through Chinese immigration restrictions. The idea that the Chinese were heathens, non-Christians, and hence not imagined as part of the manifest destiny of America as a Christian nation. That was one of the kind of planks of the anti-Chinese movement. And so the two kind of activist Chinese figures that I study, Wang and Lee, were both very prolific newspapermen, but they took two very different tactics towards this discourse of Christian kind of heathenism, or Christian discourse of heathenism that other Chinese. Wang, in a very characteristic kind of bombastic tone, produced a pretty well-known essay, perhaps the most well-known of his entire of his body of work, which is Why I Am a Heathen, mm-hmm. Which is a satirical and scathing denunciation of Christianity. And Yan Fun Lee wrote back with a rebuttal, which basically asserts that Wang's argument is bombastic and also misses the point in terms of the ideals of Christian fellowship, which is really based on an idea of egalitarianism and brotherhood or sisterhood. And so you see in my chapter how these two prominent Asian American, early Asian American activist writers were trying to disentangle and disarticulate this problematic discourse, mm-hmm. In which you see in Douglas's speech, he addresses by saying, well, the U.S., America, was supposed to be a country founded on religious freedom, and that this particular way in which kind of polemicists have been attacking Chinese immigrants, that they're not Christian, hence they are not part of the vision of America, is groundless in the sense that it really is counterintuitive to the very kind of fundamental or foundational ideals of America. So you see these three different kind of writers taking on this very kind of persuasive, unfortunately, and compelling argument, the non-Christian morality of Chinese immigrants as one of the kind of primary ways in which Chinese anti-Chinese agitators sought to push forward restrictions against immigrants to the U.S.
Yeah, and it sort of, as you sort of described in the book, it sort of provides this convenient cover and kind of sidesteps these would-be accusations of white supremacy by making exclusion about religion and morality rather than, you know, sort of race-based.
Well, I just have one more maybe point to make, too, is that the Christian discourse that I discuss in this book and how it's kind of triangulated amongst Douglas, Lee, and Wang, it was one of the primary kind of racial scripts that many kind of critics and commentators from this period identified as one of those kind of racial typologies that had been once used against African Americans during the era of slavery to disenfranchise them and also to remove them from the community of the nation. And by the time you get to kind of the Reconstruction era, you have this kind of really problematic dialectic that pivots on the question of Christianity, which is the dialectic of Black inclusion, Chinese exclusion. So proponents of Black citizenship often return to this narrative of Christianity, saying, well, Blacks are included within the imagination of America now, after slavery, after the Civil War, because they're part of the Christian fellowship that we envision this nation to be. However, Chinese, because they're not Christian, should be excluded because they serve as some kind of dangerous, kind of immoral, amoral force in the country. So you have kind of political figures who were pretty significant and influential, like James G. Blaine, whom I study also in this chapter, who was one of the moderate Republican, but Republican architects of the Reconstruction Amendments, who comes out in force against Chinese immigration. So he's able to kind of harmonize what seemed to even a lot of critics at that time as a very hypocritical position.
Sure.
To be a proponent for African American rights and citizenship, yet at the same time deny citizenship, naturalization, and immigration to another group, the Chinese specifically. And part of that is the way in which that Christian narrative was a kind of way in which these seemingly opposing positions could be harmonized in a way that did away with the kind of contradiction, I guess, for lack of a better word, that would seem Blaine's position. And part of the chapter is also looking at how many of these Black writers identified racial scripts like this Christian heathenism discourse as a way in which one racialized minority group was disenfranchised and attacked. All these racial scripts migrate or get repurposed by different stakeholders to disenfranchise and suppress other racialized minority groups.
Yeah, and there's so much that's interesting in that, right? This idea of the political opportunism, and like you said, sort of the harmonizing of Chinese exclusion with the egalitarian principles, at least on so-called of the postbellum period. And I wonder so. Maybe this kind of leads us to the third chapter, which is titled "American Futures Past: The Counterfactual Histories of Chinese Invasion," where you really talk about this invasion fiction, and you did a really very nice outline of the Yellow Peril, right? In chapter three, you sort of talk about invasion fiction having sort of measurable effect on Chinese immigration case law, and how it sort of puts the question of sovereignty center stage. And so I wonder if you would sort of talk about that. And also something else that I found really, really interesting was this the subgenres represented by Carruthers and Lindsay, and how they again turned this Yellow Peril trope on its head.
Certainly. As I mentioned before, this chapter takes a slightly different tack from the previous two. So the first one tries to chart this larger kind of episode in the archives of Atlantic slavery, the kind of rise of Asian indentured laborers to the West in the wake of emancipation and experimentations with quasi-free labor. The second chapter, as we just talked about, focuses more on individual figures and writers, thinkers like Douglas, Wong, Lee, Williams. The third chapter focuses more specifically on the development of a genre. And as I mentioned, the genre, it's a subgenre, the Chinese invasion subgenre. And there hasn't been as much work done on these narratives. There was an early text that basically offered a kind of compendium of the invasion subgenre, but that came out in 1982. And what I found as I kind of started reading widely, these narratives were extremely popular and also very localized. Many of them were produced, not surprisingly, in the Pacific Coast states, where Chinese immigration was at its height and was part of the overarching kind of anti-Chinese movement that really came to power in the 1870s, 80s, and 90s, especially in the West. The subgenre itself is really interesting. It does imagine a future America overrun, destroyed, invaded by often Asian Chinese fifth columnists. So the enemy within trope, which overtakes America from within. And there's a real kind of cautionary narrative with this subgenre, which explores what might happen if we loosen up immigration restrictions, if we offer naturalization and citizenship rights to Chinese Americans. And in many ways, what I found really interesting as I studied this peculiar subgenre was the way in which many of the texts, really the kind of specter, let's say, of these narratives was the threat and anxiety over the expansion of Black political power in the wake of Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. Many of these stories really explored what would happen to America if Chinese Americans were allowed to become naturalized citizens. And this is one of the important aspects of the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act, was that not only did it exclude Chinese laborers, labor migrants from coming to the U.S., it also prevented their naturalization to citizenship. Mm-hmm. So many of these books and stories and novels and short stories that I looked at in this subgenre really were given voice through the medium of Chinese immigration fears, fears also about Black citizenship, mm-hmm. Black rights, and the expansion of Black voting power specifically in the nation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think and I'm not sure if you were finished that thought.
Oh, sure. Okay. Go ahead.
Well, because I think that, so this idea of, you know, this subgenre serving, you know, is this sort of macro cautionary tale with these very sort of elaborate, as you said, counterfactual histories. Yeah. There's almost this sort of laughable paradox that you also talk about, which is that you've got these sort of representations of, on the one hand, the abject coolie slave, and on the other hand, you know, this, as you put it, villainous agents of foreign aggression, which, you know, which paradoxically incite both pathos and fear, as you also state in the chapter, and those really seem like to almost laughably undercut this really kind of threatening specter, because, which one is it, right? And I sort of wonder if you would talk about that, and also the part of what you just alluded to as well, this fear of increased Black political power, African American political power. This subgenre also erases the African American presence in these future imaginings, as well as the Native American presence in the past. And I wonder if you'd, talk about that.
I'd be happy to. Thank you for reminding me of the really interesting range of oddities of the subgenre. So yes, the depiction of Chinese aggressors is so complex. It's Janice. So at once they're abject coolie slaves, on the other hand, they're villainous agents. They're fifth columnists. They're the enemy within that they're just biding their time to take over the country and destroy us and us you know, facetiously, all Americans, white Americans, in their wake. So there's really kind of this interesting kind of interplay, and in many ways, a kind of weird harmonization, like the harmonization you get with a figure like James G. Blaine, a proponent of Black citizenship, but also a proponent of Chinese immigration restriction. There's this weird way in which the narrative is able to kind of harmonize these opposites. The temporal structure, as you mentioned, of these narratives are also really interesting. So even though they really channel the anxiety of Black citizenship and voting rights in a post-Reconstruction America, the stories themselves play with demography in such a strange way. You'll see that in many of these stories that I talk about, the Black presence starts to winnow away from the country. So just as the threat of Asian invasion increases, the Black population precipitously declines. Sometimes it's from self exile or deportation, in the sense that, you know, the African American population has decided to move elsewhere, back to Africa. In some of these narratives, some of them, they just mysteriously, the demography of Black Americans just declines, just drops off to basically zero, so that you have a realignment of the impending race war that's often at the heart of these invasion narratives between the white and yellow race. So there's this interesting way in which the threat is both very much of the emotional substructure of these narratives, the threat of Black political power. At the same time, the plots will often try to mitigate the threat by literally occulting, disappearing all Black Americans from the plot of the book. The other aspect, and this is a strange temporal structure of these narratives, I mean, you could arguably say that this is an early form of science fiction writing. The books and short stories that I look at have a really interesting recursive structure. Often you have a figure, a historian, in some cases, who comes back, who somehow travels from the future to the past, which is, of course, our present, to warn us in this moment as to what will happen to the future of America if we do not take a strong stance against Chinese immigration. So that you have this really interesting recursive structure built into these invasion narratives. And in many ways, my shorthand for them is that they're counterfactual histories. They're speculative fictions, in that they're imagining what this future will be, but it's a future in the story that's already happened, hence the cautionary nature of these tales. The other aspect of it, just as the African American demographic in the U.S. withers away mysteriously in many of the plots of these stories, some of these stories also have this interesting way in which white Americans or Anglo-Saxon Americans become the new indigenous population, hence quote unquote Native Americans, in the wake of Chinese occupation, colonization, and invasion. So there's an interesting way in which Native Americans too are elided from the history of America in these strange kind of time travel narratives of Asian invasion, so that it's white Americans, Anglo-Saxon Americans, who become now the true indigenous population of the U.S., uprooted, expropriated from their soil by these invading foreigners, these Chinese or Asiatic others. So there's really interesting and complex kind of racial dynamics that get worked into many of these stories. And you had mentioned the, let's say, counter narratives of Chinese invasion that I recovered, specifically the short stories of Vachel Lindsay, who's a white American author, primarily poet, and also an African-American writer by the name of James Carruthers. Mm-hmm. As I was doing my research, I came across their short stories in Du Bois's The Crisis magazine, which was, for me, a kind of surprising discovery because I didn't expect to find Asian invasion narratives in the Crisis magazine. But as I read them and started studying them, what's really interesting is that they are much in the vein of the Douglas speech composite nation, in that they offer a kind of counter narrative of Chinese invasion. So they use the genre, but they kind of flip the kind of racist dynamics of the genre on its head. So Lindsay's short story, which is entitled The Golden Faced People, a story of the Chinese conquest of America, and you can already get a sense of the playfulness of the title. His narrative really explores the question of white racial hegemony in the U.S. by inverting the dynamic, the black-white dynamic of Jim Crow America, onto the Asian white dynamic of a future America, 1,000 years hence, in which the Chinese have conquered and colonized America and now are the majority population in the country. And so he has a white narrator kind of undergo what W.E.B. Du Bois talks about as double consciousness. And it's all about this sense of the kind of anxiety, disgust, his sense of two-ness, of the whiteness of his skin vis-a-vis his now Asian superiors. And of course, the story reveals itself to be a dream sequence. So the narrator wakes up, he's in the present moment, which is roughly 1914, the time of the story's publication. And he sees lynched bodies before him, an African American, an Asian American, a Greek American. And the story really shows us, or at least attempts to kind of interrogate, the nature of white supremacy in the U.S., but also articulates something like anti-black racial violence with nativist attacks against different foreign immigrants. Different foreign immigrant populations to the U.S. So it really uses that really problematic invasion subgenre, but then really flips it on its head to really explore the kind of currents, the racial animus of kind of white ideology and white supremacy in this particular period, the period of the kind of nadir of race relations, in really interesting and critically just capacious ways. You see this too with James Carruthers, and his story was published just the same year, in fact, as Vachel Lindsay. So it's this kind of bumper, this year of a bumper crop of really interesting kind of counter narratives of Chinese invasion in the Crisis magazine. And his story is entitled A Man They Didn't Know. And this one really explores or flirts with the idea of kind of black traitors to the nation. In fact, it's looking at how black identifications might surpass the framework of the nation, so that you have kind of this idea that black Americans have become so disaffected mm-hmm. by the institutional racism of the U.S. that they're actually contemplating and actually forging alliances with Asian invaders, mm-hmm. anti-colonial kind of revolutionaries in Mexico and Hawaii. And he really envisions this kind of multiracial, anti-colonial, anti-US kind of collaboration, which in the end becomes a way to really think about black identity formation in the U.S. in ways that elude perhaps the kind of strictures or binds of the nation, mm-hmm. Kind of identifications that actually might be inimical to national identity. And, you know, the title itself is so ambiguous, A Man They Didn't Know, which mm-hmm. speaks to the main figure, who is an African-American former boxer. He kind of represents the idea of the black masses. He finally is convinced to fight for the U.S. in this imagined future kind of war with Japan in this particular instance, but Asiatic forces threatening to take over the U.S. He dies, and the kind of irony of the story is that he is the man they didn't know. So it really emphasizes the kind of resistance to capture, the resistance to full understanding of his particular experience. And it really kind of challenges an idea of knowing, for lack of a better word, the black experience as it's represented in this kind of figure of the black populace, the figure of Blackburn, who dies in the end.
That's really interesting. And I don't think that I sort of, I'm now thinking about this idea of knowing and the knowable, which in some sense brings us back to the work of Wong Chun-Fu, who's sort of big project, in some sense, was this idea of making knowable a certain Chinese figure, but I'd definitely like for you to talk sort of as you do in your conclusion about this. The sort of changing racial landscape of the Reconstruction era and how, you know, all of these things, immigration, naturalization, and citizenship policies had sort of this impact on both Asian American politics and African American life, which is what you delve into in the conclusion. But slightly before that, another sort of subgenre that you discuss, and this is in the fourth chapter, is the boycott novel. And it sort of emerges at a really interesting point, right? You talk about how at the end of the 19th century, China is now, the Chinese market is now needed to sort of absorb a lot of this U.S. industrial surplus, and is needed more so than as a source of cheap labor. And I sort of wonder if you could sort of talk about how the boycott novel relates to that that pretty significant change.
Sure. I'd be happy to. So the last chapter moves its focus away specifically from the U.S. context, more towards the Chinese context. And I wanted to offer this other kind of more transnational perspective. So among the many different cultural texts that I explore in that chapter, a good majority of which is in translation, I look at the boycott novel, which is in relationship to actually the 1905 Chinese boycott of U.S. goods. It was one of the largest mass-based protests against U.S. domestic and foreign policies against Chinese and Chinese Americans at the time. It didn't last for very long, but it did create an incredible body of newspaper responses. There was a lot of fear that this would signal the end of U.S. kind of neocolonial expansion to Asia, specifically China, which, as you said, was really viewed as a potential market to absorb the surplus overproduction of the U.S. economy. So rather than focusing on the movement or the kind of absorption of cheap laboring bodies from China, the U.S. had shifted to kind of using China as a kind of dumping grounds for its surplus overproduction. So that was charts a kind of change in terms of Sino-U.S. relations over this period period of roughly maybe four decades. And so the boycott novel are a series of Chinese language texts that emerged in the wake of this mass protest of U.S. goods. And it happened not just in China, but it was coordinated with Chinese in Japan and Singapore and British Vancouver, Canada, mm-hmm. Hawaii, and other points on the globe. And the boycott was what it was, a boycott of all things American. Mm-hmm. And as I said, the boycott itself didn't last for very long, as many Chinese scholars have noted. But what it did produce in its wake was a body of literature, of fictions, that was really invested in kind of exploring kind of the diasporic connections. In many ways, the text of the boycott novel is a translation by Lin Shu, who is the kind of preeminent translator of Western text to China. And one of the kind of flashpoint texts that he translated in the first American novel that was translated in China was Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin. It was translated, and it was a tandem translation. That was the process that he used. He worked with another translator to produce the text in classical Chinese. It was 1901. And in that text, what Lin Shu attempts to do is actually translate Uncle Tom's Cabin to address the political situation of really bellicose U.S. policies towards China. And in the preface and the afterword, he explicitly positions his translation as a kind of literary manifesto or protest against U.S. policies, against Chinese immigration, as well as U.S. neocolonial incursions in China at this time. And what he does in that text is really focus on figures like Harris and Eliza, and in fact downplays a figure like Uncle Tom. And the translation ends really with Harris's kind of pronouncement of a kind of African nationality. Because if, for those of you familiar with Uncle Tom's Cabin, this is been oftentimes cited as the most problematic aspect of this novel, is that George Harris and his family relocates, they leave America and they go to Liberia to start anew, away from the U.S. nation state. And it's often referred to as a separatist ending of the novel. But for a figure like Lin Shu, he actually seized on that idea of an African nationality, the separatist ending, as a way to think through a kind of Chinese nationalism in opposition to U.S. neocolonial practices, policies, and ideologies. And it really works on this idea of a kind of sentimentalism that gets translated to a U.S. context as a kind of way to position Chinese in the diaspora, in all different parts of the globe, as a kind of communal identification vis-a-vis the incursions of America. And you see a lot of this kind of sentimental structure coming into play with the genre of the boycott novel, where you have a similar attempt to kind of give voice to a communal identity forged in relation to U.S. kind of hostility or attacks, anti-Chinese imagery, as well as policies. So that this entire last chapter is really trying to think through, in translation, how Chinese writers were trying to address, respond to, give voice to a kind of Chinese identity formation vis-a-vis U.S. exclusionist, restrictive, and neocolonial policies.
Yeah, and yeah, there's a lot to think about there, and I found this last chapter really, really fascinating, particularly because a lot of the exclusion, the rationale for the exclusion was predicated on some of these sort of some of this othering that really had this dehumanizing tone of, you know, the home lives, you know, were questioned and as being sort of fundamentally un-American and that kind of thing. So this idea of these narratives recuperating that and as you said, sort of leading to this very specific identity formation is really an interesting, very interesting one. This has been a really, really fascinating discussion for me, and I really, again, enjoyed reading the book, and I'm really thrilled to have had the opportunity to discuss it with you at length. I wonder if you would sort of tell us what you're currently working on.
Sure. So I'm actually just at the beginning of a third book project, and much of it, I believe, will center on a recently recovered narrative, which is Caleb Smith's edited Austin Reed, The Haunted Convict. It's the first Black prison narrative in American literature. It was never published in its time. It was a manuscript that was discovered by Yale archivists that has recently been published and made available to the public in book form just last year. And the next project, I think, actually goes back in time a little bit and goes back to the antebellum period and even beyond, perhaps to even the 18th century. And I'm really interested in looking at the system of indenture as it migrated from the European or British context to the U.S., and particularly the indenturing of young children. In the U.S. context, indenture was predominantly a mode in which Native American and African American minors were bound by contract, even though they were minors. Actually, children were allowed to make indenture contracts before they were of an age of maturity, in which you have what would become, to my mind, a kind of form of unfree labor under the aegis of contract in a different context. So in many ways, it's kind of expanding on the work that I did in this most recent book, looking at Chinese bonded or indentured labor, but going backwards in time to look at its formation and establishment within the U.S. in the late 18th and early 19th century as a particular way in which children were coerced into forms of labor and labor bondage, even in under the auspices or guise of free labor. And I'm emphasizing this because the Austin Reed narrative begins with his indentureship, and indenture quickly turns into a lifetime of imprisonment, reformatories, and then imprisonment in Auburn State. And I think the second book, I'm at the very early stages, I'm really interested in looking at how indenture is one of those systems of labor coercion that is relatively unchallenged throughout the century. So that by the time you have Reconstruction, you have Freedmen Bureau agents indenturing Black children, regardless of parents' decisions or preferences, as a way to mitigate Black dependency on federal aid. Indenture is still actually a term that is in use in certain skilled crafts and trades. So I think I'm really interested in thinking about how indenture as a construct within American legal as well as labor history has been a way in which forms of unfreedom have continued, and particularly racialized unfreedom for a demographic that perhaps only now is becoming increasingly kind of studied, which is children, minors. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that sounds like a great project, and I look forward to hearing more about it as it develops, and certainly once it's been published. Thank you again, Professor Wong, for coming on the show. Folks, you've had the pleasure of listening to Professor Edley Wong, the author of Racial Reconstruction, Black Inclusion, Chinese Exclusion, and the Fictions of Citizenship, here on the New Books in African American Studies podcast. Thanks again, Professor Wong, for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me and for all the questions.
None at all. And folks, we'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.